And welcome to The Smoke Break. I'm your host, Joel Pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Jane Malone.
Hey.
Real quick disclaimer, this podcast is for entertainment purposes only. We work in the field of mental health, but don't claim to be professionals in this space. Our work and intention is to have conversations around lived experience. As a result, we may not always agree or disagree with everything our guests say, but we do intend to hold space and open conversation so that way we can learn from one another. Jane, so glad to have you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Real quick trigger warning on this episode, we're going to be talking about eating disorders and suicidal ideation later, so if that's something that might be a little bit too heavy, you can go ahead and just watch the first half, because the first half we are going to talk about
early experiences with
therapy
and mental health.
Yes, you got it, and introducing topics the right way. So yeah, we wanted to talk
we're a team.
So what experiences have you had with, like, maybe even going to therapy?
So when I was growing up, my parents, and they still are, in fact, they are still very evangelical, fundamentalist Christians. And so my first experiences with therapy were all along the biblical counseling kind of
biblical
vein.
Counseling?
Yes. My parents split up when I was 8. And so we did a round of, like, family biblical counseling so that they could part in a way that kind of still kept our family intact.
Okay.
And that did not happen at all. But it was really, that's what they tried to do, at least. And then after they split up, we went to a regular, a secular counselor.
Okay. Ooh, fancy.
Right? And then I had some issues later on in life. And so I went to a court-mandated therapist for about 6 months after I had a suicide attempt when I was a kid. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a lot of your early experiences with therapy weren't exactly, like, voluntary, like something that you wanted to do.
No, absolutely. It was always something that was either, like, it was required for my parents to be able to split up by the church. They required us to do that.
And then,
in order for my dad to keep his spot in the church and still divorce my mom, we all had to stay in the church, which was really, it was challenging for her because my father had had an affair and he immediately married this other woman as soon as they were apart. And so then he brought her in and kind of just put her in my mom's place, you know? And
that, like, sounds awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. And so for him to keep that, she had to stay in the church and still be faithful to the church. And it was pretty wild.
That definitely speaks to, like, the complexities and just challenges with, like, the church. But
they get you in there and they don't like to let go.
Yeah.
So
when you were going to, like, therapy, like, some of your earlier experiences, like, I'm kind of curious about this biblical counseling. Did you feel like it was helping? Did you feel like the answer was always God?
You know, I feel like the short answer, yeah, for any of the biblical counseling stuff that you come across is always going to be, you know, just give it to God.
Yeah.
And that helps a lot, I think, if you believe in God. I've always struggled there, you know? So it's, I don't know. Great claims require great evidence, you know?
Sure.
And so there wasn't necessarily that, in my opinion, which I understand that I did not, you know, some people really do feel that there is a higher power. I've never really felt that. And I tried to shine it on for a lot of years to make my family happy, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, it just didn't ever work for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of an unfortunate thing is that, like, with those early experiences with therapy kind of, like, stick,
yeah,
you know, where you're just like, I remember going to this, needing help and not getting it. So, like, what's to say it's going to not be like that later?
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, that's actually something that I, like, address with clients. Like, when I have younger clients that have been to, like, mandated therapy, it's like really important to be like, hey, like, let's address the fact that, like, you may have felt like you needed to perform in the past or, like, to answer questions in a certain way. And, like, now you've chosen to come to therapy. And, like, obviously that's great and shows that you want to better yourself, but, like, there might still be some stuff in there around that mandated experience of being forced to talk about things that were hard or, you know, at least that's what it felt like from your perspective.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's, and even also too, like, when a minor, you know, goes to therapy, the parents have a certain amount of, you know, access to everything. And, like, that's also, you know, like,
I can feel scary because, like, you the things that, like, you might be talking about might be your parents.
Absolutely.
And for them to just have, like, a window into your soul, like, is kind of scary.
Oh, yeah. And I've heard a lot of people say, like, they lost trust in their therapist because their therapist shared something with their parents that they didn't want them to. And so, like, that's something I really try to navigate carefully with people is, like, what are you comfortable with me sharing with your parents? What are you not comfortable? And then obviously, like, legally you have to share, like, safety concerns, make sure they understand that going so they can have the autonomy to, like, choose what to share, you know? I think being forced to go to therapy as a child then can also often make you feel, like, less reluctant or more reluctant is the one where you don't want to do it, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
to want to seek that help and see how it could be helpful because you just had this negative experience.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of, because it was Christian based and Christian focused, there was a huge pressure put on everyone to just forgive my father. You know, it was one of those things where it was about forgiving him and lifting him up and like everything was just fine. But like, I just don't think that you have enough time to process what had happened. I was eight, you know, my whole life just changed. My mom and dad are in different houses. He has a new wife. Like it was a lot of downshifting. And it was almost like instantaneously expected. Well, he said that he made a mistake, so you have to forgive him.
Right?
Yeah. But like, I don't know that he ever actually did say that. I mean, like they said it for him several times, you know, but I don't know that he ever actually did. So.
Well, and I think that like kind of speaks to like the importance of like you being able to process something before you get to a place where you forgive, you know, like to demand forgiveness from you for like something like in a situation that you feel harmed is extremely unfair.
Absolutely.
When it's just, it's so much. Just to expect from a child where the entire, it feels like it's not much of a world, but the whole thing has blown up.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It just felt like they put a lot of pressure on us to just kind of gloss over it and get over it. And my mother was devastated, you know, like
exactly.
We were watching her in real time. Like we watched her heart break and her start her life over. It was awful.
Yeah.
And you're eight. So it's like, you said you were eight, right?
Yeah. I was, and I was on her side too. I was furious. I'm still furious. I'm still furious at him, you know, for putting us through all of this.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But it's a lot to conceptualize as an 8-year old.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So you had talked a little bit about going to therapy a little bit later in life. About how old were you?
So I've always been very academically strong, but I have a lot of social issues and I think that I might have autism. My son has it and it typically is genetic, but they didn't really have autism for women in the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I was just mysteriously good at math. we don't know why this one can count. Yeah. Anyway, I still have a lot of social anxiety and a lot of social issues and stuff. And so nothing had ever gotten better after they had split up. My stepmother we still have a very strained relationship, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was really hard. I was living mostly at my father and my stepmother's place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I was having a lot of behavioral issues. So they took me to a therapist and I'm sure that she tried really hard, but like it was the 90s. And I don't think that we didn't know
as enough.
Much.
Yeah.
It's like any science, you know, it's developing as we go. Like nothing's fixed. It's just a description of what we're seeing. You know? So.
And it represents like the cultural spot and time that we're at as far as like all the other issues. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So she had me like I wrote a poem to my dad and I still don't think he ever read that. I'm not a strong poetry student.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it a good poem?
No, I don't think I've ever written a good poem.
You're all hate you, Dad.
What just rhymes? Made it rhyme.
You're always late. But at one point I had to draw, or I didn't have to, but she had asked me to draw a picture of my dad. And I do like to do art. Yeah. So I'd gone all out and drawn.
You're a wonderful artist.
Wonderful artist. Thank please,
you.
Please go to her for any of your stuff.
Right. I'm very moderately priced anyway. But I had drawn a really nice picture of my father. And then she had me tape it to this like board and you threw these soft darts at it. And it was just, it made for pickup time to be really awkward, you know, like the drive home was weird because of it. And I know that she was trying to help, but I don't know how, you know, like I get like you have to kind of show up for kids where they are in time. But even at like 13 or 14, I thought this is nuts. Like this one's insane. So
a lot of your like early experiences sounds like it didn't do for you what therapy does for a lot of people.
Absolutely. I think that the second therapist and I were just like a bad fit as far as
that's that a real thing too.
That is a real thing.
Because I am kind of cerebral, I'm going to need somebody who's very intellectual, who's very like able to explain like, oh, well, this might be this or this might be this, but we have to do more work to find out. And she was much more, let's draw and, you know, write poems to
just
our
say whatever
guilt
you want.
Yeah. And I do think that there's definitely benefit in therapy. Just I haven't been able to access therapy that really works for me in any way.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of out here wilding, just trying to raw dog in life. So many STDs.
They're brain STDs. It's fine.
Yeah. You can't see them.
You can't see them. Well, I imagine that like those experiences that like that you had while you were younger made it difficult to even try to like get to a place where you were ready to like be like, okay, people are talking about this at open mics. Does it help? You know,
you know, from what I see at open mics, it does not. No, that's not where you want to get your evidence from.
What they meant was I go to therapy, and then they meant they were there at the open mic, and you're like, oh, that's not therapy.
No, they say it all the time. They're like, this is my therapy. I'm like, I don't think
that does not count as therapy.
OHP is not covering.
Girl, that's why your jokes are bothering everybody.
Yeah.
Please get regular therapy. Yeah. I at this point, because I'm older, I'm 43, you know, I've been unmedicated, undiagnosed, it's such a scary basket to even, it's like that closet that you've just got chock full of all kinds of shit, and a lot of that shit's negative, you know? Mm-hmm. And so like when you go to even like pass it in the hallway, sometimes you're like, fuck, don't touch the handle. It might all come crashing out. Yeah, it's a little bit, it's daunting to think, like, to try to unpack all the stuff that you've been through, because, like, until today, I probably hadn't thought about my parents' divorce in, like, a decade, because, like, so much other trauma has happened, you know?
Right.
Like, I have my own divorce in there somewhere, and, like, it's...
Well, I think I like that you kind of said that, is that, like, you don't really have a chance to unpack everything, mm-hmm, because, like, your life keeps moving.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, like you have this thing happen and you're like, oh man, I should take time to focus on this. But like things keep happening.
Oh yeah.
And so you kind of just like, I guess it's on the back burner. We'll worry about it later. And just everything gets put on the fucking back burner.
Oh, absolutely. It's my grandmother died during COVID, but it was during COVID. So I was already overwhelmed with so much death and so much horror that like her passing took like almost a year to be real to me in some way, you know. It didn't really feel like it had actually happened for a long time.
Well, I bet you've probably though like developed a lot of coping mechanisms on your own, like, you know what I mean, like the fact that you made it this far and you are successful and like you thrive in several, like, lots of ways that I can see, you know what I mean? So I think you've probably, like, maybe we don't, not everybody gets therapy, but people do find ways to overcome and to heal, or at least to keep going. Right?
Absolutely. I know that people cope in a lot of ways. I personally am a throw yourself into work person.
Yeah.
You know, I like
one of my
a
people.
Project. It gets to the point now where like, so I work for the Infinity Room in Salem. Shout out. They're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Great space for comedy, music, the whole nine. And they do, they take a weekend off every summer and they get a camp. They rent a camp.
Oh,
they all
cool.
go up and they have a blast. It's like 3 days up in the mountains.
That's cool.
It sounds the pictures look amazing every year. They invite me every year. I have never gone because I'm afraid they're gonna find out I don't know how to relax. I don't know how to sit there and not work on a project. And for 3 days, do you know how long 3 days is if you don't have a project?
3 days of free time?
It's so much time. I could get so much done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, while you're relaxing, you could think about all the things you could be doing, you know?
List.
Damn, y'all both went for lists.
I dated this guy for a while, and he would sit on the couch on his days off, and he would just lay there, and it looked amazing. And I would be like, doesn't it ever get you the guilt, like, of not doing the things you need to do? And he's like, I never think about that stuff. He said that he was lazy minded. Like, his mind just didn't come up with a list of shit that he needed to be doing while he was.
Can you imagine?
Great.
It's like a superpower.
Yeah,
100%. I don't even know what that would be like. It's amazing.
Yeah. It's like people who say that they don't have like an inner dialogue and shit.
We
I'm just like, that's
that.
So fucking weird. Like, you're just walking around, just pictures.
Does
like,
it just
what the fuck?
Bark?
It concerns
what
me. I don't know if that's.
Yeah. How do you reassess like everything you've ever done if you're not thinking about everything you've ever done?
How do you feel guilty about that one time when you showed your boyfriend your bra strap in third grade?
Yeah, there's no time.
I don't know where that wasn't like based on anything. I thought his mom was
We can unpack this because we have a minute before we wrap up.
I really did. I thought his mom was mad at me for so, and like in my head, I was
this
like, this
did
hussy.
Happen.
I didn't even have like real boobs yet. You know what I mean? Like, what was I thinking? Like,
a training bra.
Yeah, exactly. It was literally a training bra. Oh, and I like tried to be, and then I was like, she knows. He told her and she knows. Every time she'd pick him up, I'd be like, oh God.
Oh
yeah,
my
that
God.
That was one of my earliest, like, really paranoid.
Is that the first thing that you worked through in therapy? You're just like, so this one time.
No, but it is something that I was like, felt guilty about for like years. And like, now as an adult, look back and be like, wow, I think I had an anxiety disorder as a child, maybe.
Yeah.
I had like a stomach ache about it for like a year. Yeah, that's
Well, I mean, I think with like, you know, like a lot of that childhood stuff, like getting access to being able to find somebody to help you is like super important. But
for sure.
You know, I don't think it's absolutely necessary. No. Therapy isn't for everybody. And like, if it's not the right person, it's definitely not for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that, you know, like enough times passed that like we kind of know what we want in a person and, you know, this in just in general. So, mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Absolutely. Thank you all for having me.
Yeah, awesome. All right. Well, we'll be right back with a smoke break. And welcome back to Smoke Break. I'm your host, your old pal Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Jane Malone.
Hey.
So during this section, we wanted to talk about, quick trigger warning, suicidal ideation. So that's something that you kind of talked about wanting to talk about. And it's something that's very close to me because, I mean, some of the first times I even went to go see a therapist, I was very young. This is a weird sense. I was always into self-harm. Like it's like, how do I say that? But I was just like I hurt. How do I externalize this pain? How do I feel it in a different way? How do I control it? But I think it's something that like can also follow you into adulthood and, you know, being able to manage stuff like that is extremely difficult. So like what capacity did you kind of want to talk about this topic?
So I've struggled with suicidal ideation for as long as I can remember, really. Like I was a small child when I first started like cutting and hurting myself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but it's always kind of resonated with me because I have a harder time being happy than a lot of people.
Sure.
You know how it is, like you come up with ways that you can address it, ways that it doesn't hurt too much to talk about it. So in my family, we call it a lavender melancholy. And the people in our family just have this lavender melancholy on them. And it's really hard to control. My grandfather and my uncle also struggle a lot with suicide. So it's definitely, it's a family trait.
Yeah.
And I don't know. After my parents divorced, it got much worse. And then I had my first suicide attempt, I think when I was 12. And then I had to do a little bit of therapy after that. And then I had my second when I was 16. And then I had to have I had to have court mandated therapy for 6 months. And it was okay. It's never really gone away. I think that I was very idealistic as a child. You know, I grew up in a bubble of like evangelical Christians where right was right and wrong was wrong. And it was very black and white.
Yeah.
You know, it was very. And so I grew up thinking that things were very idealistic and that there would be like, I don't know, this idea of like
bad people get punished, good people get rewarded.
Yeah, absolutely. And love triumphs all. And, you know, it doesn't matter what you do because you can't, you know, what's meant for you will be there, you know,
sure,
and
these, sure.
All these ideas that aren't necessarily true, which I know is trigger warning that there may not be a God.
Yeah. Like, we've talked about that in length.
The way that I had grown up is that we were God's favorite, you know, not just that we were blessed by God, but God liked me specifically because I'm funny or something. Yeah, what I mean? Like, and so
why wouldn't he?
Yeah. I'm amazing. Just so we're clear. If God doesn't like me, that's a taste issue. Anyway.
That's on him.
Right? I'm a delight. I had thought that this world was going to be quite a bit different from what it was.
Yeah. So it was kind of like the shock of being like, this isn't how I was hoping.
It is not just how I was not hoping it. It is everything horrible that it could possibly be.
Yeah.
All of my enemies are in power and my heroes are dead.
That's
awful.
I think that's a really interesting perspective, though, because being raised, because I know a lot of people that were raised religious and have trauma around it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't really thought about it like that, like the idealism of the idea that like everything happens for a reason and that God's always watching. And then, I have thought about that before. But then when all these terrible things start happening, you're like, cool. So God sanctioned my trauma and my abuse and all these other horrible things that happened to me and me feeling less than my whole life or whatever. And then, you start to feel like, what the fuck?
It's what kind of God would want me to suffer?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I think like with like suicidal ideation, I think like oftentimes like people aren't trying to escape life. They're trying to escape suffering.
For sure.
You know, it's just like, this hurts. How do I make it hurt less? And maybe like not even hurt forever. And that's like, I feel like that's the make it hurt less is maybe like where the self-harm, you know, is. Mm-hmm. And I think like not at all is, you know, where the rest comes in.
A lot of times it's a dull ache. Just being alive has this dull ache associated with it. Like I woke up again, and it is
or depression,
it's like that for me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
I'm when I'm depressed, I feel that way.
Yeah.
If I'm going through it, yeah.
And so that's always there, you know, it's mm-hmm. like it doesn't ever leave unless it's not there. And then there's nothing there. Sometimes there's just this huge void and I don't feel anything. It's good. It's bad. It's nothing. Mm-hmm. And it just feels so.
Which one do you think's harder?
The nothing, the hopelessness, the stagnancy of the fucking there's nothing. It's so bad.
Yeah. Well, I feel like at least if things are going poorly, they're going, you know, it's like it's once I've lost hope that like that's where I really start.
Ideation.
Yep. I start having ideationing. We'll figure out a word. Not professional, said at the beginning. But yeah, that's like where I start having like the ideations is because it's like I feel like whatever situation I'm in isn't going to change. And it's just like, all right, well, then like, why would I continue to watch a show I know has a bad ending? You know? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, totally.
Cut it off the third season. You know?
I don't know that I'm even rooting for this protagonist. You know what I mean?
Oh, amen. Amen. I've seen everything the protagonist has done. You know what I mean?
All you're kind of a shitty person. I can't speak. To you, but like
No. I very much agree.
I don't agree with either of you right now.
From a professional standpoint, Zoe
keeps us alive.
But I would say that like sometimes it doesn't feel like we are rooting for ourselves, but I would say like through your actions of like continuing to create your art and like doing what you do, you know what I mean? Like there's a part of you that is resisting that, or, you know, that is persevering and showing you what there is if you stay, you know? But I do think it's really important to talk about the fact that like some people do experience suicide, we call it like passive suicide. Mm-hmm. I think you might have said that even, but like that's actually more common than I think a lot of people realize. And that some people, even with antidepressants or, you know, whatever, treating whatever they find out is going on with them, if there is an imbalance, still experience that. And I think it's like I don't think enough people talk about the fact that it's just like some people just experience suicidal ideation. Of course, ideally you're going to have it better controlled and like have quicker ways to move through it or to talk back to it or whatever. But like I think it's a real thing for a lot of people. And I think it's cool that you both are like willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
I've experienced suicidal ideation. I wouldn't say that it's always there, but I would say like if I get dark enough. Yeah. And it, you know, it's usually that thing where it's not a plan necessarily for me. It's just like, this sucks. I'd like to not be here right now. You know, and then you have these weird fantasies of like what your funeral might look like, right? We've all had those weird ones. Yeah. I think that's just I think that's just a human thing to a certain extent. And so I think, I just think it's important to talk about. So I appreciate it.
I appreciate that. Something I wanted to ask you about is you were saying that there's like the I feel bad, waking up and feeling bad, then the like waking up and I feel nothing, you know? So like with hopelessness, like what helps you navigate hopelessness? What gives you hope?
Okay, so this is going to be very controversial. I have children and they do not keep me from wanting to kill myself. They are marvelous children and I love them very much.
Sure.
But this life, it doesn't just hinge on one person for any of us, or it shouldn't.
Yeah.
And so for me, what gets me through is knowing that eventually, like my son's 13 now, but eventually he'll be at a place where I can leave. And it won't be as devastating because like I have a friend who lost his mother at 13 and he is absolutely hilarious. And I want more for that for my son than that. You know, he's a good kid, you know, and he deserves to have the support system that I provide for him into his adult years. And I am trying very hard to make it to 60 because I had him at 30 and that means he would be 30. And if I make it to 60 and I haven't killed myself, I feel like I fucking won and I get to kill myself.
Yeah, which honestly.
Which doesn't sound great.
You know what? As somebody who's had the same thought, I'm not even like,
you got to play weird games with yourself sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Like it's not an ideal, but if it keeps you going,
Exactly. It's just like, I only have to put, you know, it's like getting to the end of your shift.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it feels like a really long work day if you're just there for forever. But if you're just like, I'm off in like 5 minutes, you know what I mean?
If you break the last 35 into the last 15 into the last five, you know, and then you can handle it.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say is like, you know, like even the thing that you said, you know, like could be considered controversial, but like, I don't think of it that way because it's like, if we truly have autonomy over our bodies and our lives, like, why can't we decide like, okay, I'm done, you know?
I have hyperlipidemia. It's just a thing I've got. It's a genetically mutated version. And so for a lot of people, it manifests as like a high cholesterol issue. No big deal. For me, it's more than that. And so my lipids pool up underneath my skin and I have these huge scars from where they have to take them off. And like genuinely, I'll be out of here 63, 65 at the very latest with a heart attack. And heart attacks fucking hurt is what I hear. Like they are a monster of pain. So I would like to just slip away on like an overdose of heroin. But apparently that's cool. Very problematic. Well,
I heard it's fun.
I mean, this is one of the few states that we have assisted suicide. And my mom is really dark. She talks about this a lot, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I agree. Like, I know it. And I'm a therapist. So it's like extra tricky to talk about this because like one of my core responsibilities is to try to help people not commit suicide. You know, yeah. Like, or one of my like it's a really important part of being something you got to take really serious and got to create safety plans with people. But I also think on a moral level, I do. I think there's a really interesting conversation around why shouldn't we have autonomy over our choices? And some people suffer. And like what you said about like not having your children necessarily be enough to, I mean, obviously in some ways they are, but it's not.
They're wonderful children.
Well, it
makes me think about Robin Williams or somebody like someone who suffers with depression their whole life. And then, you know, they end it and everybody's like sad, but it's also kind of like, hey, if that was the way that they felt like was an out, yes, it's fucking sad. And yes, it's hard for the people that love them, but there's a certain level of like, we should have autonomy over the way that we exist. And if the way we exist is challenging, obviously I want you here for as long as possible. But it's a real conversation. I think it's important to talk about it because I think a lot of people don't talk about it. And then there's a lot of people actively experiencing it and being like,
and feeling shame.
Yeah. And feeling shame that you've played that mental game with yourself around it. For right. Sure. But I mean, it's clearly not a totally rare thing for a lot of people. And I think it's good to talk about it and stigmatize it.
Well, and I am an artist, you know, like I'm a lifetime artist. I put 20 years into it. I'm not making $1 million. I don't have healthcare. This is America.
Yeah.
They don't give artists healthcare, and that's fine. But that also means that I don't have money for the end of my life.
Being
older.
Yeah.
Like,
wow, that's really
if I do have a heart attack, that comes with a shit ton of medical bills and getting you better and like, you know, the whole rehabilitation.
You wouldn't want to put that pressure on your family to be like, hey, pay for this.
I don't want to be a burden to my family.
It's a complicated conversation.
I was a burden the whole time. I'm going to be
I don't think you were a burden the whole time.
Bite my butt. Oh, I'm a pain in the butt. They're fantastic. But like, I am a difficult person. I know that, you know, like.
I like difficult people.
Me too.
Yeah, I need pushback.
Well, I also need people that can handle me. So I'm like, hey, you got a little stuff you need? I got some too. So But no, I was going to say my mom, she talks about the idea of like, because she's like 70 something now. And she talks about wanting, like being like, well, I'm not going to live that. And we're like, mom, quit being so dark. But she's really kind of like realistic about it. Like, also, I don't want to suffer. Like, you know what I mean? She's like, so she's really interested in the idea of assisted suicide. And also she wants to compost her body. And I watched, watched a whole documentary about that recently about they have these like composting things that they like turn and you get, and then you can be, which is essentially what we do anyway.
That's so much cooler than the time box.
And it feels a little dark sometimes when she brings it up, but I really appreciate the fact that she's always been comfortable being a little dark with me because I think it's important to think of our mortality as humans.
Yeah.
I think it's a good reminder for lots of
reasons. I think so too. Well, I think like, you know, even on the topic of just like contemplating our mortality is like, it's without an ending, it makes like everything between the beginning, you know, like fucking
it's
meaningless.
Yeah, it
because it's like
anyway.
You could do it later.
Take it seriously. Yeah, you take it more seriously when you realize there's an end point, right?
Like
it's part of the beauty of humanity lies in its frail nature. Yep. It's beautiful because it doesn't last forever, because it is so fragile, because it's over too quickly, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's why it's lovely. And I think that like you can't have the good of it without the dark of it.
100%.
Like that's it's a beautiful dichotomy.
I agree strongly.
And I want my kids in as much as they know anything about me, they know exactly who I was. Like, I have no idea who my dad is. He is a mask of a man to this day.
Yeah.
But my kids know me all the way through. And I think that, you know, I was real with them. I had real connections with people. And I loved my people. You know, like, that's all you can really ask
for. I like
for.
That. Yeah. I like you so much.
So out of curiosity, you know, I guess, like, you know, somebody who also has had attempts and stuff in the past, like, are there any experiences that you're glad you were able to have and that like it's almost like I'm glad I didn't do it because I got to do this?
Oh God, I'm working on it. For a long time, I felt really good about doing comedy. And then I thought that that was kind of like going to safeguard me from having any more problems with suicidal ideation.
Yeah.
You know, I'm good at this. I'm fun. There's that huge adrenaline rush you get.
You're very good at it.
Thank you. I really try hard. But I had... God, as with everything, there are ups and downs in comedy, and some of the downs are so devastating that you think that it's really not worth it anymore. So like, I would love to say that, no, I haven't, but like I had an attempt last year. So it's not even like I'm that far from it. Well, it's just they're getting the spaces between are getting longer.
Yes, I like that. Yeah, I like that. I like that. I think that, you know, a few years ago, like I was, you know, I've always struggled with depression, struggled with like suicidal ideation and stuff like that. But I thought that like once I'm doing comedy, once I'm doing music, once I'm doing all the things that I want to do, these thoughts are going to go away. But like the thing is like they don't go away. They're just now hinged around the things that you're doing. Yeah. You know, it's just like, oh, like before I felt bad about, you know, being alone or whatever. You know, it's like now I feel bad about not doing well at comedy. Also, I'm still alone. Yes. Like,
I end my sets that way. All right, guys, at the end of the set, I'm still single and we didn't solve anything.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, I guess for me, you know, there are a lot of experiences that I've had since some of my attempts that like I, you know, at the time, like I couldn't see the light. I couldn't see it ever getting better. And the fact that it has, the fact that it's changed in the ways that it has, like has allowed me to be like, hey, if you had stopped it right here, you know, like this, it, yeah, you're right. It couldn't have gotten better because it stopped right there. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm grateful for you still being here.
Yeah, same.
Some days are good. Well, today was all right. So that's exciting.
Yeah. Hey.
Thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah. Indeed. Always glad to hang out with you guys.
Yeah, we appreciate it. All right. We're going to take one more break and we will be right back with the smoke break. And welcome back to The Smoke Break. I'm your host, Joel Powell Zane, here with Zoe Schwartz.
Hello.
Jane Malone.
Hey.
So during this last part, we wanted to talk about something a little bit cheerier, eating disorders.
Not a ton cheerier. Woo-hoo.
Not a ton cheerier, but like slightly.
I mean, it's got a buffet right in there.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So in my experience with like eating disorders and stuff like that, it kind of was born from being poor.
Yeah.
So like my uncle, I almost said uncle at the time, like I had a later one, my uncle would like, he was the only one working in the house. He was providing food for everybody. And there were times where he would make food. I would eat it and then I would still be hungry. So then I would go back for seconds and then he would shame me.
Yeah.
And he'd be like, oh, you don't need seconds. You know, we all don't have enough. Blah, blah, blah. So I'd feel bad. And then what I would do is like, I would go to a friend's house and I'd be like, well, fuck, they have food. And then I would eat their food. And then they'd be like, this person comes over here and eats our fucking food all the time. Like this is also a problem. So they would shame me. So it eventually became like, I couldn't get the nutrition that I needed at home. And I couldn't get it from like outside. And I just like, it kind of just became like a control thing of just like, all right, well, this thing that I'm doing seems to upset people, and it's feels easier to not do it, and like the amount of time I can go without doing it and not realize that like, oh, I haven't eaten, you know. I'm now more aware because I find myself getting angry, you know, or I'm just like, oh, I have a really fucking short temper, maybe I should eat something. But like what's been your experience?
Oh, it's been fantastic. Now,
I imagine.
So I grew up in America, circa now. So I was 300 pounds in high school. So I've always, I don't know, it really affects a lot of stuff because I was big all my life. And so at some point, I have hyperlipidemia, which I mentioned before, but also here I have it again. And so I've always been bigger. My lipids don't burn, they store. And so that's exciting. And my dad really, really hates fat women. And so that has always been kind of a sticking point for him. I thought it was really funny because when I turned 13, I was like, oh, I've been on 13 diets before I was 13. And I thought that was hilarious, but that's actually just child abuse.
Yeah,
it really is. We were very religious. And so on Wednesdays we would fast, and I was like 7, 8 years old and I couldn't eat at elementary school on Wednesdays because we fasted, you know. It was just wild. So I've always had kind of an unhealthy relationship with food anyway. But like as I got older, it got much worse because like kids start putting on weight 9, 10. They get a little chubby, then they shoot up and then chub up and they shoot up. And it's just like kind of inchworming their way up, you know.
Yeah.
And so whenever I'd get bigger, my dad would just get so upset and he would sing that song, "You Can Have Her, I Don't Want Her, She's Too Fat For Me."
Jesus.
Oh, who sings that song? Let's find them.
Let's cancel that guy.
I thought he made up that song for me, but he didn't. That's just a country song. That's just a song that you can sing to your daughter.
I won't.
So we've had a lot of struggle because he doesn't like fat women and I have always been one. Like there was once I got to college. I went late. I went to seminary first, and then when that didn't pan out, turns out I'm a woman. Who knew? I knew. But then I went to college and like I got really anorexic in college. And so I went from about 300 pounds, which is where I sit today. And I was 156 pounds. And for my body style, I was really lean, you know?
Oh, yeah. That's tiny. I've never been that small. Yeah.
I was pretty lean. And so, but I was running like 18 miles a day, eating like 600 calories. Yes. Like I was really sick. But everybody kept telling me how great I looked.
Right? Isn't that the most fucked up part?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. My dad kept calling me the comeback kid. And it was just like, he couldn't believe that I turned my life around. And
I can't believe he hinges your life being around that.
Oh, no.
People do, yeah.
My worth is directly related to my relationship with the gravitational pull of this planet. I swear to God. Not just for other people. Unfortunately, it's so ingrained in me now that like when I wake up and I'm light, I'm a better person. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like I'm just a better person. Well, I don't know.
And it also ties into the whole like idea of like women taking up less space and like disappearing and all of that. Like there's so much in there. And how you mentioned that like eating disorders, there's a lot of control involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's also a lot of, there's control. But there's also a lot of like, do I deserve to exist? Do I deserve to take this space up? Yeah, no, there's a, I can relate to
that part of it.
Yeah, I can relate to a lot of the stuff you said.
Yeah.
Like, I got put on a diet when I was 11.
Really?
I went to Weight Watchers. Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure it's illegal now to go to Weight Watchers
when you're 11.
When you haven't gone. Yeah, and then what did I do? I gained weight every single week because I was going through puberty. And then I started binge eating because I wasn't allowed to eat and I was fucking hungry.
Yeah.
And I've had a fucked up relationship with food ever since.
Yeah.
I'm a great sneak eater. Like, no one ever sees me eat anything. I have a hard time eating in front of people. Because like, okay, so I would get a plate and I would sit down at the table and my dad would come up and he'd look at my plate. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the plate instead of talking to the microphone. He would look at my plate and he would count up in his mind how many calories were on it. And then he would say that number to me and he's dead on accurate. Like he's within 10 calories.
He's a dickhead, but his math is good.
He's a savant. It's amazing. They talk about it all the time. But I'm also very good at it now. So that's exciting, you know, but that comes from 4 years of anorexia. So
Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's definitely hard to like, for me, it's like trying to create a new relationship with food. Like something that like I have a really hard time with is people offering me food because like I believe that there's a resentment that they're building.
Okay.
Because like I'm just like, oh, you're saying I can have this, but you're also like thinking that you gave me something. So like now like there's this improper balance of like, well, now I have to give you food. And like maybe if I just don't take it, then I won't owe you anything. And it's just like, it's very much like a control thing for me. It's like I never really had like body image issues of like looking at myself and being like, well, I mean, that's a lie. I wear a fucking sweatshirt since you've ever seen when have you seen my arms?
Never.
You know what I mean? It's because I'm self-conscious about how skinny I am. And like, that's another side of it is that like people, are like, oh, you're so skinny. And it's just like, that would be a compliment maybe for someone else. It's not for me. I've tried to put on weight.
Murder for that.
Right,
compliment.
Right.
Well, but that's another thing that I think is a really important thing I learned through this whole journey is that like, we just shouldn't talk about other people's bodies because you never know. Like I've heard so many stories of somebody being complimented and one, they're starving themselves and they're in like the depths of a really horrible eating disorder.
Yeah.
Also, there's lots of fat people that are starving themselves and everybody assumes like you can be anorexic and be 300 pounds. Okay. Just so everyone knows. And they prescribe anorexia to fat people. So the amount of calories that they tell you to eat to go on a diet would equal anorexia in like a relatively to compare to someone, you know, so it's just, it's so fucking layered. And I learned so much about it. Yeah. But I think, but also like the conversation around poverty or like lack of access to food, like, that can cause eating disorders too. There's so many, it's like, your brain doesn't know the difference between, real starvation and perceived starvation. So if you think you're starving or if you are choosing to starve yourself or what, you know what I mean? Like it your body reacts. So there's so many layers to it. Like I just really went down the rabbit hole.
I appreciate that.
No, I mean, in general, when I tried to unpack all my stuff, cause I got really into dieting.
Yeah.
No one ever diagnosed me with an eating disorder, but I absolutely had one because all I thought about was food. It was calories in, calories out all day long. I was on my app. I would get mad if I didn't know how many calories were in something. It took me years to stop counting the calories. I still feel guilty about food, but I mostly eat whatever I want, but I still have body issues. But I just have chosen to not diet and try to be thin, but it's like the battle never went away.
It's everywhere.
Still battle with my body every day, even though I know dieting is not a solution to the problems. Because that was the other thing. I got skinny and then I still hated myself. And I was like, wait, so the prize doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And then all these creepy dudes want to have sex with you that didn't before. And you think that would make you feel better. But then you're just like, oh,
why didn't you like me before?
Exactly. And then it just reinforces that you're more valuable as a thin person. And you're like, why am I doing this to myself? Mm-hmm. Like,
I never got thin enough from my own self-respect, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was 156 pounds and I'm 5'6". So I was within 20 pounds of what legally I'm supposed to be.
Oh, yeah. And you're still considered obese at that weight. I know, I'm still
21 pounds overweight. I could not get to 135 and I fucking tried. I could have cut off a leg and maybe, but I tried.
My lowest, I was still considered obese. And I'm like, this is wildly unhealthy for me. Like, you know,
like this feels unhealthy. What's been everybody's experience with like the whole not eating and then eating being more difficult because you haven't eaten?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think what I learned is that restriction for a lot of people can lead to binging. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of even restricting in your mind, telling yourself you shouldn't be eating something, that can cause binging.
Oh, for sure.
Even if you aren't actually restricting. So that was a real mindfuck. What it did for me is it really opened up the mind-body connection and how much that our brain can like affect our body in ways that we don't really realize. Yeah. So that was
and how much our body often affects our brain too.
And how we need food to be able to think straight. So it's like,
oh, shit.
You know, that's the other crazy part of it.
Baloney. Because like I can give up meth. Like I never,
exactly.
I don't need to smoke, but I absolutely have to eat. And making me choose like 3 meals a day that so are hard. Like good for me.
Yeah.
I'm just fucking shoot me. Just
yeah. Well, it's like I forget to eat. So it's like whenever I eat, it's almost like an emergency.
Yeah.
So it's like if I eat anything in my brain, I'm saying, well, this is better than not eating, even if it's bad to eat.
I'm not allowed to eat. Period. In my head, I'm not allowed to eat. So I go as long as I possibly can without eating.
Yep.
And then I eat everything in sight because I am ravenous and insane at that point.
Yeah.
You know, and then it has to be in secret because if people see me eating, they're going to know that that's how I got fat was because I ate stuff. Right?
No, and this is the shit that runs through your mind. No, I literally have had all these thoughts before. Yeah.
Well, and like the things that like I didn't realize that were like triggering to me were like people commenting on the food I'm eating, people commenting on the way that I'm eating food. Mm-hmm. I had somebody, I won't say their name. I had somebody
if
like.
It wasn't me, I'm sorry.
No, it wasn't you. It was Taylor.
That's what happens when you're not here, Taylor.
Yep, well, that's what happens. But he.
Did you see his shoes last week? I'm just kidding.
God, he looked fly. I'm just kidding. Shit talk him. No, but like the thing is like we're always riffing, we're always joking. Yeah. So we have like this funny rapport, but like I don't think he realizes how much it impacts me because I was eating something in the office and he's like, you know, like just made that sound, made fun of it. And I was just like, hey, homie, like I need you to not.
Yeah.
Because like that's really, like it makes me feel stupid for eating. It makes me feel like I eat weird. It makes me feel like I shouldn't be eating.
And my dad makes piggy noises when my stepmother walks by. Porkisha. He'll call her Porkisha.
Jeez.
I don't love your dad.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest too.
My 13-year-old son, every time we bring up my dad, he goes, Dan.
Yeah. Your son sounds cooler.
Yeah.
Your son sounds cooler.
My son loves me. He loves all the squishy parts of me and does not give a shit. He fucking loves me.
Yeah, I think little boys with fat moms are like helping solve the world a little one step at a time. Yeah, because they're like, this person took care of me, loved me. Like, I just think more people.
You see them as a person.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
It's like my mom has struggled with like weight loss and stuff like that, but I think watching her struggle made me understand the impact of like the comments, you know, because it was like I was a kid and I was just observing things. I'm like, that person, you know, and she's like, hey, like, do you get that like I'm that. So when you say that about that person, I feel that way.
Absolutely.
And it's like it helped humanize. And it sucks that like in so many situations that you have to be in a situation to understand that the people in that situation are humans. But like it really
fat people aren't human to people yet. I mean, even Netflix's Baby Reindeer just came out. Huge hit. The first sentence out of it is, I felt sorry for her. That's the first thing I felt.
I haven't watched it, and I'm
and
glad.
He's talking about how she waddled up to the fucking bar as a fat woman.
And she's like a desperate stalker in the isn't she? Like
yes,
a stalker.
Yes, and she's like my age, and she's my physique, and she's.
Yeah. And that's the only representation you see. I was going to say, that's another example of like.
We get Bridgerton, we get the fat girl gets her fucking season, but she's not even that fat. She's just got a softer body shape.
Yeah.
Like she's really.
It's wild what was considered fat like in the 90s.
Yeah.
Do you remember when Jessica Simpson was fat and she's just wearing like a size 10 bad jeans?
Yeah.
Like, she's
Raven
bad
Simone,
jeans.
She was fat too. It was like, they're just not skinny. That's all.
Yeah.
Topanga, remember Topanga? And it's funny because I've heard a lot of, you know, remember that show, Boy Meets World? I've heard a lot of dudes my age now tell me that they all had the hots for Topanga. And see, I'm like, yeah, everybody always liked thick girls. They just didn't. We just weren't allowed to talk about it. We were allowed. But
Well, and I mean, like, it speaks a lot to like how often in media, that like somebody who looks like you, it gets represented in this negative way. So you say like, is that me? Is that my representation? Mm-hmm. Am I also like, do people also feel sorry for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I asked Billy, actually. I was like, do you think they feel sorry for me? Like, cause what's his name at Haymaker, the cute, Nick, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like, because he's so cute and I crush on him all the time. And so like I walked in the other day to do a set and I was like, oh fuck, he feels bad for me. Like that's the first thing that happened. Cause he is that good looking kind of bartender guy. Yeah. And I am everything described by about Martha, you know? Yeah. Like I am weird and luckily, alone and sad.
No, you're not. I love you. No, but luckily what I've learned is like we're always meaner to ourselves than other people are actually being. You know what I mean? Like that's the thing that sucks about receiving those messages is that then we end up being our own worst critic.
Yeah.
And like often, I mean, yes, people are shitty to fat people. Like that's a real thing.
Yeah.
But I think I'm shittier to myself probably than other people are. It's so dumb. You can hear like every time you think of one of the like one thing someone said to you, it just rings in your ears mm-hmm. forever. You know, yeah, it sucks. But I think we're finally getting to a place where it's a little bit better.
Yeah, I feel like it.
And I feel like there's a much bigger conversations around eating disorders existing sure. in people other than people socialized as female. I think, you know, like there's all these conversations around fat people having eating disorders. You know, just all this. Yeah, I just think
the complexities of it.
Exactly. The nuance, the complexities, the fact that most people are impacted by body and food issues yep. in some absolutely. Way in their lives. You know,
our culture is ruthless, absolutely ruthless about your body. It better be fucking right. You
yeah.
know,
and
it's not nice. It doesn't promote people who aren't the right way. It doesn't fucking look kindly.
It's a hierarchy. That's the hierarchy, oh, right? Yeah. That's how we hierarchy people is our bodies. And yep. it's like. Yeah.
Well, I think like the conversations that we have and the way that we decide to like talk about these things are going to be the ways that we role model even talking mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. these things show that like, you know, that there's a better way to have these conversations. If you're not at a weight that you don't want to be at, that's a different conversation than
for sure.
I'm not at the weight that somebody thinks I should be.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that there's a thin enough for my father. It's one of those things where like it wouldn't matter what I did. I would never be enough for that person. So at some point you have to just be okay with exactly who you are.
Enough for you.
Thinks anyway.
No.
All right.
Dan.
All right, Jane, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a blast talking with you.
It's been so fun. Thank you.
Yeah, excellent. Well, that has been The Smoke Break. I've been your host, your old pal Zane. Here was Zoe Schwartz.
Bye-bye.
And Jane Malone.
Hi.
All right, later, players.